Welcome to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to this, our latest live Burr News Facebook interview. Joined today by the Minister of Government Reform, Levita Foggo. Thank you very much for joining us and sparing us some of your precious time. It's much appreciated.
It's my pleasure.
Before we go into matters that affect your ministry, there is one outstanding question, an issue that's grabbing all the headlines today here and around the world. That's the question of the governor giving assent to what I refer to as a same-sex bill. I saw a quote, and it's obviously a bit of dark humour, but he said along the lines of, one half of the world thinks we're a corrupt tax haven, the other half now thinks we're a bunch of homophobes. It's not exactly the best publicity that Bermuda wanted, is it?
Well, I would say no, but let me say this. Prior to becoming the government, our platform clearly indicated what our direction would be with respect to same-sex couples. So it shouldn't be of any surprise to anyone within the community that we went to the Parliament and brought forward a bill that we wanted to make sure would ensure legal rights of same-sex couples. And so this jurisdiction is one of very few in our hemisphere that has done anything tangible to ensure the rights of same-sex couples. So we applaud the minister who carried that legislation. And we feel that at present, and in response to the community at large, that we found the best balance and in trying to ensure that same-sex couples' rights are secured.
This obviously is not your ministry, but presumably there's been discussions at Cabinet on this, and I don't know if you can tell me what they are in relation to the next question, but have you guys anticipated that there might be a legal challenge to this?
I would leave that for the minister at large to respond
Fair
to
enough,
that.
I,
that falls under his remit.
I did notice today that a British minister, I can't remember her name, did note that the Act, as it's being passed, might actually satisfy the European Court of Human Rights Act. Sure, so I just wondered if there was going to be, would be room for a possible legal challenge.
Anything going forward with respect to this legislation, the respective minister will speak to it.
Fair enough. I wanted to ask about it because it's a topical issue of the day.
Yes.
Just moving on more into the realms of your ministry now. Obviously, it was announced recently that there's going to be a split in the roles in Cabinet Secretary and head of the Civil Service. This was something I know that you guys brought up and said you were implementing the Sage Commission recommendations on that. They did make a point, the Sage Commission, though, of saying that there should be very specific job descriptions for both posts. Is that something you're looking at the moment?
I think that with those two titles, it's not the first time that that's been in existence. So we have actually reverted to what had been in place once before. There was a separation between Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service. And so we have just reintroduced that so that each entity can specifically focus on what will fall under their remit. So, and the Premier is responsible for ensuring what head will deal with what within
so just
government.
Given that, then, what do you expect that the what do you think will come under the role of the head of civil service? I mean, the cabinet secretary is fairly straightforward, but head of civil service, what do you think they will be? I know they're responsible for the civil service, but what would you like to see them inputting? What kind of, because you're obviously talking about reforms.
Well, all I can speak to, Mr. Deacon, is the fact that that is part of what will fall under their remit. And again, that is still being looked at and finalised, and I think if I say anything to that, it's premature.
Who will be responsible for hiring? Will that go to the Public Services Commission?
Yes, any upper-level position in government falls under the PSC.
Okay, and of course the Sage Commission did talk about abolishing the post of Assistant Cabinet Secretary.
That's what was stated. So again, as I said, that falls under the remit of the Premier, and whatever decisions are made there
Sorry, it's my misunderstanding then. That's not part of government reform. That's not your ministry at all.
Say that again.
That's not part of government
there
reform.
There are certain parts that fall within the Office of Cabinet that falls under my remit, and some which, right, of course, falls directly under the
Slightly
Premier.
Slightly confusing, but this, yes, is the Premier's remit.
Yes, okay, for the most part.
Okay,
yes.
Well, I didn't realise that. I do apologise. So it's a bit early to say about the post of Assistant Cabinet Secretary. That's going to be a Premier's decision sooner rather than later, I
guess. Yes.
Just moving on then from that, I just wanted to address that very briefly, but moving on, that you've made a few statements recently in the public, and last week, January the 31st, you talked to small and medium-sized businesses, and you talked about a code of practice for the project management and procurement, and said that preference in the awarding of contracts will be given to small and medium-sized businesses and businesses with a well-established Bermudian employment base. Can you just expand on that? I mean, I just wondered if you've got a kind of example or a definition of what you mean by an established Bermudian employment base.
Well, yes, I can do that. With a company that, for instance, let's say, is predominantly Bermudian earned, with a large portion of their employee base being Bermudian, and we want to make certain that companies like that will fall within a matrix and will get, at times, preferential treatment depending on the procurement of the goods that we're looking at.
So you're going to actually, as part of the bid, you're going to ask them to break down their employment?
That may be part of it, yes. The matrix will be put in place, and they will assess the companies that are coming forward to give bids, and depending on how they align with the matrix that they're measured against, as well as looking at things like good value, that will be the part of the determining factor in terms of who ultimately.
Okay, so part of the determining factor.
Yes.
So I was going to ask, if you've got two companies neck and neck, but one employs one more Bermudian.
Well, again, procurement will look at the organization that they feel will best get the job done in terms of good value for money and the like.
What kind of contracts are you talking about? The reason I ask that, it's been in the news in the US recently, where FEMA awarded, I think, a $30 million contract to supply ready-made meals to Puerto Rico to a single-person company. What kind of contracts will you expect? What kind of size of contracts do you think will be governed by this?
I think when you're looking at small and medium-sized entities, there will be the opportunity at times for them to partner with bigger companies if we're looking at a contract that they may not have the manpower or the resources to be able to handle on their own. We're looking at every option possible to ensure that companies, small businesses and medium-sized businesses, along with others, have every opportunity to participate.
What I'm saying is if a Bermudian company just a bid for a contract by itself, not partnering, mm-hmm, is there going to be a ceiling on the cost of that contract, say $1 million, $500,000? Because sometimes, you know, you get a small company that bids for it, you're going to win, but they're not able to carry it out. And I quote that FEMA example. There's another one. I think they employ somebody with a workforce of three people to fix all the telephone wires in Puerto Rico, and they just simply couldn't do it.
But all of this type of criteria are assessed. So if it's a company, right, that's only three men strong, and it clearly requires some a company that has to be approximately 50 men strong, the Office of Project Management and Procurement will be looking out for situations,
right,
like that.
Mentioned the office. We talked about a code of practice. You talked about a code of practice for that Project Management and Procurement Office. Has that been tabled? Has that been drafted?
The practice, yeah. Yes, and it did go to the House.
Right,
yes.
I couldn't see any record of it anywhere. Mm. Well, not in, when I did the web search anyway. I didn't look at the House of Assembly website.
Right.
The website. Can you just tell me what that says?
You should be able to find it online as well. There should be.
I'm obviously not very good at searching online. So could you just tell me a little bit of what it involves? What's in the code? What are some of the key points?
Well, it basically speaks to the conditions and requirements that any company would have to meet in terms of whether they're going to be bidding for a project that says, let's say, falls within the $5,000 to $100,000 range, projects that are above that, and the regulations that will govern any project that falls below that and falls below $1,000. So it's all of those types of things mm-hmm. that are highlighted within that code of practice that those who are coming to offer government a service will have to abide by. As you know, government must ensure that it maintains a fair, open, and transparent practice and allows for every opportunity for all players to be able to come to the table.
Talking about transparent, it was a time, and I don't know if it still happens. I must admit, I haven't looked for a while, but government would publish all the contracts. Is that mm-hmm. still going to happen? All the contracts you had and the people who won it?
Well, they will publish. There is a matrix within the code, and it has been even prior to the changes that were made. There is a matrix that states there's a list of businesses. Sometimes you can use part of a practice within the code that you have a preferred list, and you'll use that list for certain services.
So what I meant was that there was an announcement mm-hmm. where XY company had got X bid for X money. And I don't know if that still happens, but with these contracts, will you still be publishing those details?
We will, according to whatever the requirements are, we will adhere to the requirements that are highlighted within the CUM. I don't want to sit here and say that I can remember every single aspect of the CUM.
You met recently with the unions to talk about change management. And you said it was a part of an attempt to improve public service efficiency, and it was the first of a series of meetings. What do you mean by change management?
I guess if you're the way, for instance, using even the, if you want to look at the union negotiations, the way in which that has been handled, we want to make certain that best practices apply and that going forward we use those types of best practices, and we look at situations like incentivizing employees and things of that nature to ensure that we are getting good value and adhering to best practices and allowing opportunity for those who are employed within the government body to get training, move up, all of those sorts of things.
Because to me, change management, and I have to say, I think I've been through more change management courses than I care to remember. Change management is leading people through the change that they don't necessarily want to have to do.
Right.
And are you kind of proposing, are you trying to lead the union into changes?
No, we're including the union. What, as you know, this is the Ministry of Government Reform. And in order to ensure buy-in, in order to ensure that we get the best advice from all entities, including the union, because they deal with the workforce, their views and their opinions and their input will be valued, and we want them there partnering with us to ensure that whatever practices are put in place are there for the benefit of both the organization of government and the worker, him or herself.
So you didn't propose any changes to the unions as such, just...
I'm not sure, quite sure. That's an open question. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Well, like I said before, change management to me is leading people through steps of change they don't necessarily want to make. And so I was just wondering, you didn't actually address to the unions changes that might be forthcoming. You're just trying to get them on board.
Well, we're still in the initial changes. We are in the initial steps of government reform. And so having finished our union negotiations, for instance, with the BPSU, one of the things that we did is reach back out to them to open conversations in terms of, as you know, that this ministry is here and we will be looking at government reform of the various government departments, and we want to ensure that we can invite you to come to the table to assist us with making whatever modifications we think will be best for the workforce going forward.
And that was well received?
Yes, it was.
I'll go back to your statement. You talked about part of an attempt to improve public service efficiency. What do you mean by public service efficiency?
Well, in looking at the public force at large, we have to look at all of, I guess if you will, the nuts and bolts of government, and we want to make sure that whatever policies are in place and the like are looked at from the lens of any modifications to be made will enhance efficiency, make things go quicker, make things run smoother, perhaps even the cost savings mechanism. So we're looking at all of those things because ultimately, and I think that you will agree that there are times when you hear the public outcry that anything within government takes too long. So we're looking at it through that lens and through other lenses to ensure that whatever reform takes place will be reflective of input from both the workforce within, as I said, the union, and whatever surveys that we've had done, use all of that data to determine what departments, what changes should be made within those departments, and if there's duplication of services, trying to eradicate the duplication of services and trying to consolidate where necessary so that government can run more efficiently and be more responsive to the public service itself and the wider public that we are here to serve.
Presumably as well, usually efficiency means lower costs.
Which is why I said where applicable, it will be can mean less money being spent out. I did mention that.
That it's an enormous job.
It is.
Even for a government the size of Bermuda, which yes. obviously is not as big as the US or the yes. UK, it's an enormous job.
Yes.
Are you hopeful of success in some form? Have you got any sort of measurements, any benchmarks that you're going through to measure where you're going?
And going forward, yes. We are even looking at the way we evaluate the public service and making certain that we do put in appropriate benchmarks, appropriate evaluative tools and assessments so that we can measure both in the short, in the short term and ultimately in the long term to make certain that the changes that have been put in place prove to be beneficial to the people we serve.
And how transparent do you hope to be about all these changes and these efficiencies that you're going to make?
Well, as a government, we promised two-way communication, if you will. Mm. We did promise that. So on many of the initiatives, we've already gone out to say this is what we wish to do it, and we will continue on that line in terms of where we can get public feedback, even within government, get feedback from the workers themselves to help inform change that everybody thinks will be beneficial.
We'll move on, address efficiencies later on during the interview. We'll touch upon it, I'm sure, but I know for this interview, it was quite interesting. I had to recap on the Sage Commission as well as the Commission of Inquiry. And I'd forgotten how scathing the Sage Commission was about the civil service. I mean, they called it a flawed organisational structure in which principles of best practice management are not enforced and which are cumbersome. The legislature is too big for the size of the country. There's no integrated process for planning and measurement. And I could go on and on and on. You really do expect to be able to address all those issues in the Sage Commission and others?
Well, let me say this up front. There were some things in the Sage Commission that we believe needed to be addressed. And
you were very plain about that in the friend speech. And your
exactly. And hence, I would dare say that hence the Premier's decision to have a ministry that is focused on government reform. And having said that, let me first say that we have some excellent public servants who do excellent and stellar work.
And over the Sage Commission mentioned that,
yes, and I want to echo that because I think all too often they end up getting a scathing report that is unfair to the majority of the workforce. It is incumbent upon us as ministers to, wherever we see that there are fixes that need to be had, to look at those areas and address those areas so government can operate more efficiently and effectively and be responsive.
Sage Commission does say the size of the silver surf is too big for a country the size of Bermuda. Obviously, under the OBA, people were let go through voluntary retirement and voluntary redundancy and early retirement and stuff. Are you looking to reduce the size? If you come up against this issue where you find an efficiency you want to place might mean the loss of five jobs, are you prepared to take that step?
I think what we're actually looking to do is right-size government. Right-size government, meaning that we have the appropriate man force for a particular department so that we can ensure effectiveness, efficiency, accountability.
According to the Sage Commission, you should downsize, not right size.
Yeah, and as I said, we're not following everything in the Sage
Commission. I understood. Commission. I'm referencing it because you guys did so.
I will say it like this. In focusing on consolidation, there may be some areas where you may see a downsizing, but there may be other areas where you will see an increase. Whatever the demand is, that is where we're going to put our focus, because we're not going to strictly adhere to something that says downsize if that's going to be counterproductive to government meeting its aims and objectives.
I'm desperately looking for my notes. Here we go. When you're talking about writing the size, I'm jumping ahead, but I want it's appropriate time to do this. Talking about the Office of Procurement and Project Management, the OMP, the OPMP, mm-hmm. When you're talking about right-sizing, one of the things the Commission of Inquiry did say was that it was basically very understaffed.
Okay, and I think that since which they have had two extra staff members come on board to help them in their deliverables.
Okay, so is it fully staffed?
I think they may be one or maybe two men short. I don't want to say for certain, but I can say this, that there were two extra persons that were transferred over to project management and procurement, and they have become permanent staff.
Okay, just for the viewers, I just want to read what the OPMP does, and it says it provides oversight mm-hmm. of all government procurement and capital projects and ensures that there is no bias in awarding contracts and handles complaints. Now, you said last year the OPMP is up and running, and I wanted to see how that your up and running definition compares to what the Commission of Inquiry said, because they said when it was a year ago this month, actually, they came out with their report. In short, its purpose was to add another layer of independent oversight of government expenditure and of capital projects in particular, so as to ensure compliance with government policies and procedures. Mm-hmm. And this is a key part. We express disappointment with the slow rate of progress that there has been in fully implementing these measures, particularly with regard to the Office of Project Management and Procurement. Says it is yet to be fully established, and the delay may be due to a lack of political will or to bureaucratic reluctance. Now, clearly, a lot of this goes back to the previous government,
yes.
I understand. But I wanted to reference it when you said the OPMP is up and running.
Yes,
and there's
it
a
is.
Clear
one of the first, and that was that, part of our 100-day initiative, was to get that practice.
What's your definition of up and running, though, compared to the Commission of Inquiry?
They're already doing the works that they're supposed to do. So I'm not sure what the not being in office back then when that statement is made, I'm not sure with what they're doing today compares with what was being done back then, but I can tell you that they are there doing the job that they're supposed to do.
So when you say up and running, you're happy with the job they are now doing?
I am happy with the job that they are doing, and I will be happy when we continue with our reform. They are out now, project management and procurement, as you I think opened with or stated earlier. They held a meeting at the Chamber of Commerce, basically letting their members know how the practice will be there to assist and what it will entail. They had a meeting scheduled with the construction group. So they are out trying to make certain that those persons who will come to government and work with government in carrying out its deliverables will get the type of assistance and practice needed in order for them to be successful in doing work for government. And so I have to say, yes, they are up and doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Now, just again, some of the Commission inquiry referenced and some of you've referenced as well. They talked about the legislation required, the legislation said it, the OPMP, required the production of a code of practice. And they made
said the
legislation for the OPMP required a code of practice.
Yes.
They make the point, like I say, and this report was a year ago, that at that stage when they were writing, it was on the 16th draft. And then you said, said there would be a stronger code of practice, and I wonder what progress, if any, had been made on that.
Yes, that was the first thing that we did coming into office within the first 100 days, is to get that code finalized. The code has been finalized.
It has been finalized, okay.
Yes, it has.
Good.
And
so that's a 17th draft.
But the code has been finalized. And when I spoke in Parliament, that was the code and of practice then.
Okay, yeah, so you were tabling it then?
Yes.
So it wasn't clear in the report? So
yes.
Okay, excellent. Talking about codes of conduct and codes of practice, etc., one of the big things you're looking at is a ministerial code.
Mm-hmm. Looked at, fast hands.
Well, okay, thank you for saying that, because again, I'm not clear. When I was researching this, you said it's expected to be tabled in the coming weeks. Has it been tabled then?
The ministerial code of practice... did we table it?
This was last year, I think.
Yes. It falls under the remit of the Premier, that the actual implementation and all of that. I can tell you that all of the changes to the ministerial code that we sought to input have been done, it has been finalized, and there is a final document.
So it hasn't yet been tabled?
I don't believe that we tabled that one. I think when I spoke to Parliament, I had the code of practice there with the ministerial code to be tabled, but it has been finalized, and it was finalized within the 100 days. Yes.
Can you tell me any notable new additions?
Basically, I think let me put it this way. That every change that was made to enhance accountability with ministers. But again, that the code itself falls directly under the remit of the Premier,
right.
And those questions should be addressed.
Okay, I'm showing my ignorance, unfortunately, because when you talked about it, I assumed that you would be dealing with it.
Well, part of the administration within the Cabinet Office falls under my administration, my ministry, and so the administration of some things falls under my remit, but there are specific things that do directly fall under the Premier, and certainly being the Premier and ministers serving at his pleasure, that clearly falls under his remit.
Okay, so when you said ministers have been required to surrender gifts valued in excess of $250, can you talk to that at all? And how has that changed?
I can say that, yes, we have a declaration form that where we have to, any gifts that come, get filled out.
Because it was going to be, you did say that ministers would have to...
Ministers are already doing this, yes.
But they would have to declare it as soon as possible after the receipt of all gifts of any value.
And they do that. They have to do that. That's part of what the code requires them to do.
So that's not part of the amended code?
Yes, that's a part of
the amended. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the code that you've amended.
Yes, that's...
Okay, so why so low?
I can't...
But if I buy you a $3 cup of coffee, you're going to have to declare it?
I would say that most ministers shouldn't allow you to.
That's why you're like, that's a problem.
And then that way they won't have to declare it. No, but seriously, this does fall under the remit of the Premier.
Okay, fair enough.
And like anything else, it's subject to review. So if that's a practice that the Premier feels needs to be changed, he will do so.
Can you talk to how this will be controlled, the code of practice, how it will be monitored, who will be in charge of...
Well, I can tell you that the PSs will be responsible for their respective ministers to ensure that whatever gifts they receive are recorded on the form that they have, the disclosure form, and it will be filed. And I can tell you that will... that process will be digitized as well. So
what will the penalties be?
That remains for the premier to determine.
Okay, I'll have to direct all these questions.
Yes, you will.
There is one question that I hope you can ask. You were a member of the Joint Select Committee on Parliamentary Governments. It came out of a report in 2014. Mm-hmm. Maybe just your personal opinion on this. When we're talking about how will the code of conduct and declaring gifts or not be governed, you talked about setting up an ethics committee. Mm-hmm. Is that something you'd still like to see?
Well, I don't know. I've sitting in with a minister's cap on, no matter what I say, whether it's personal or otherwise, will be seen as what the minister says. I will answer that this way. Part of my remit is to work in tandem with Parliament, because anything, any changes that happen within the parliamentary body is controlled by the House. It is not controlled through government proper. And so it is, if you will, Parliament does not sit under a ministry. It is an independent entity. And being such, I have no direct say as to what will happen within the legislature.
But
it's determined that falls under the Speaker, not me.
Presumably you were in favour of the Ethics Committee when the report came out.
We put that report together because we thought in moving, when I sat on that committee, that is a part of best practices, that's part of the benchmarks that all legislations that fall under the Commonwealth are trying to meet. And yes, having an ethics committee was one of those benchmarks and one of those items that were considered as meeting best practices. And so I'm not opposed to that, but it doesn't fall under my remit, and that is something that the Speaker will have to determine.
Speaking of the Speaker, when you talked about parliamentary oversight committees, you said those were a matter for the Speaker as well.
Yes.
But clearly you're working closely with the Speaker to set up, I think, three permanent parliamentary oversight committees.
I worked in tandem with the Office of the Legislature in setting that up, but ultimately that still fell under the remit of the Speaker, who determined whether or not.
Sure.
Yes.
But you were behind driving it. I just wondered if those committees have been set up and what they are.
Well, the Speaker announced that three committees would be set up, and those committees were highlighted in Parliament, and they grouped certain ministries together that I guess that the Speaker felt were best fits, and I can't remember the actual details for each committee, but I think at least three members will sit on each committee that will be tasked with looking at the operations.
So they exist now, do they?
Yeah, I don't know who the Speaker has named on those committees.
So again, I can find records. Yeah.
But the Speaker would be able to answer these questions much better. But I can say that he made that announcement in the House of Assembly. And I don't want to assume the role of the Speaker by speaking for him. So.
Understood. I want to talk about the commissioning inquiry a bit, and this does touch on government reform, so hopefully it falls within your commission of inquiry.
Okay.
Hopefully it does fall under your remit. Now, it made a lot of recommendations regarding government reform. I can't go into all of them because there's a lot of them. And clearly, former Premier Michael Dunkley held a press conference last summer or thereabouts, I think, and announced a few initiatives that they were going to do to address some of the Commission's recommendations. But one question to you is the Commission of Inquiry report and any of its recommendations regarding better governance, are they regarded as being of any use, of any value by your government?
Well, that does not fall under my remit, and those questions are questions that should be directed to the Office of the Premier.
Fair enough. Can you talk about financial instructions?
That falls under the Ministry of Finance.
Yeah, it's very, It's a very confusing issue, I have to say. And I'm clearly quite confused by it because I always thought it fell under government reform.
Financial instructions fall under the ministry.
Even though they don't
know what question it is that you're trying to ask me about financial instructions.
I just wondered. It was talking about the giving them regulatory power, giving them legislation to give the financial instruction statutory effect. So it was basically a breach of it, was liable to a criminal prosecution.
Yeah, that definitely will fall. The Minister of Finance would be best.
Fair enough. Should have done my research more closely. But can you talk about the parliamentary, the PAC?
The Public Accounts Committee, I did sit on that for many years. But again, that's one of the entities that the government had said in its platform that it would try and enhance the work of the Public Accounts Committee. And the speaker did basically, I believe, when he was putting the three committees together or spoke to the three committees, did likewise speak to ensuring that the Public Accounts Committee would be, the works of the Public Accounts Committee would be enhanced. And again, when it comes to anything that is totally parliamentary in nature, it does not fall under the government banner. Mm. It falls under the legislature.
I raise it because, again, you're quoted as saying you noted the priority given in the PLP's 100-day agenda to strengthen the PAC's good work.
Yes.
And I just wondered if you could talk to what has been done to strengthen its good work. Because one of the things
I can tell you that the speaker, one thing that he has done already, he sent the entire Public Accounts Committee over to Great Britain to a seminar. I think it was for about a week. So they have had some hands-on training, and they just returned, just having done that. So that shows the commitment to ensure that the work of the Public Accounts Committee will have the benefit of extra training, and in so doing, hopefully, enhances the ability of them to continue to do their work.
One of the issues that was raised was about the lack of funding and the lack of human resources I have in terms of administrative help, and also the Commission noted that there was a tendency for politically affiliated members to form a bloc when through their absence at committee meetings deprive the PAC of the attendance numbers required for a quorum.
And I believe that the legislature for this budget year have put together a budget where they will be looking for, I guess, something that will allow them to move in that direction of enhancing their role in serving both the MPs as well as reaching out to the public at large. So I think that they will be able to move further in that direction in terms of meeting best practices.
Because that's one of the key committees, isn't it, really, the PAs?
Yes, it is. And that's why I said that the speaker, in ensuring that they are going to have the benefit of best practices and can do their jobs on the level that's desired, sent them overseas to a seminar, the entire Public Accounts Committee.
So in terms of your ministry then, what key initiatives have you got on the go at the moment?
Well, we are looking at reforming with and consolidation of certain areas. And so we are now looking at that in earnest, and we are just, I guess if you will, making the determination as to where our focuses should be. I can say that, for instance, in education, there some consolidation took place with the archives and the library. So we're making little steps. We are still in progress with looking at government committees and the like, and consolidating where we believe consolidation should take place so that we don't have committees overlapping and where there are committees that are defunct or do serve very little purpose or no longer aligned with what this 21st century society needs, then committees like that we will be looking to either get rid of or subsume them into other committees.
That's already
being done. And I think the next area to look at will be within the Ministry of Transport, looking at some of the committees that they have, and many of them do have overlap. So there's the recommendation, but of course, ultimately, what gets done ultimately will have to pass the test through cabinet. So the recommendations will come back to cabinet, and whatever cabinet says is what will be.
So that's been a pretty busy 6 months for you.
Yes, and it remains busy, and I think, how can I put it? The fact that a ministry has been established, we've had governments in the past who have talked about reform and actually have not done any reform in a meaningful way. I think that by establishing this ministry, one, it makes clear to the public that we serve that we are very serious about making certain that government is accountable, works more efficiently and effectively for the people that it serves. And so we cannot just jump in willy-nilly and do things. We do have the benefit of the Sage Commission. Mm-hmm. We have the benefit of the works that were done some years ago. I think it was the Civil Service Reform. I'll call it the Civil Service Reform document. And we have the benefit of documents like that to use, as well as what we are doing going forward to determine the best way forward for this government. We're focusing on the IT structure, for instance, and making certain, we're rationalizing that and making certain we know what changes need to be made to ensure that our e-government platform is where it needs to be in this 21st century. And we're making good inroads.
Okay. On that note, Minister, thank you very much for your time. It's appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com, your 24/7 Bermuda news source.